Okay, good morning, members. I call the Committee on Human Services, Finance, and Policy to order. Today we have three bills we're going to be hearing, and we're going to be getting more bills to our committee. And so to make sure we can get through on time, as we have a hard stop at noon, I'm going to limit questions from members to two questions, so one question and a follow-up, just to make sure we can get through all of the bills going forward since we're approaching deadline. So with that, we're going to take roll call attendance. Please proceed, Ms. Hansen.
Good morning, everybody. Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Lead Albright. Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Present.
Representative Fisher is excused.
Fisher's present. Fisher made it.
Sir.
Thank you.
Hi. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Hansen, present.
Representative Keel.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Moore. Representative Novotny.
Novotny present.
Thank you. Representative Pearson.
Pearson present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Sandell.
Present.
And Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Thank you.
Hey, we have a quorum. Thank you, members, for always being on time to committee. We really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. So the next item we need to do is take care of the minutes from February 23rd. Vice Chair Bonner, would you like to move the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would like to move the minutes from, I believe it was yesterday, the 23rd.
Thank you. Vice Chair Bonner moves the minutes from February 23rd. Any questions or corrections, comments on the minutes? Seeing none, please unmute yourself. All those in favor of adopting the minutes from February 23rd, 2021, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, minutes are adopted. Thank you, members. Okay, the first bill we have for consideration is House File 970, but before we do that, I'm going to move to adopt the committee report from the Behavioral Health Division. All those in favor of adopting the committee division report, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the division report is adopted. Okay, I'm going to move that Representative Vang's bill, House File 970, be re-referred to the committee, to the Commerce Committee on the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. Sorry, we have the bill before us. Representative Vang, welcome to our committee. Would you like us to move your A3 amendment so we can get in the shape you'd like before the presentation?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
Okay, so I'm going to move the A3 amendment. All those in favor of adopting the A3 amendment to House File 970, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the A3 amendment is adopted. So, Representative Vang, again, welcome. Please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is my first time presenting in this committee, so it's good to see all of you. I'm happy to present House File 970. First, I would just say that this is one of the more exciting bills I'm carrying this session. With 10 ayes and 0 nays passed in the previous committee, this bill not only has broad bipartisan support, but also broad community support. As you can see by the number of written testimonies and letters of support from community members to advocates and professionals, it is no secret that we have a dire mental health workforce shortage that needs to be addressed, especially in light of the increased needs due to the pandemic. For a long time, poor access to mental health care include rural communities where individuals are less likely to have a mental health treatment facility than metro counties. Communities of colors are less likely to get the treatment they need, and low-income communities are less likely to have the mental health treatment resources than high-income communities. So this bill brings comprehensive support and addresses a number of things that my testifier can go through the bill to elaborate on each section. I think that it's what's important to highlight is the amount of work that has been put into this bill to address this workforce shortage. This has been a result of coalitions and advocates working across the state to create these recommendations that now shape this bill. In 2013, the legislature passed a bill requiring MNSCU, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, to convene a task force to develop a comprehensive plan to increase the number of qualified people working at all levels of our mental health system, ensure appropriate coursework and training, and to create a more culturally diverse mental health workforce. Meetings were held across the state, surveys were conducted, and a large summit was held. Since then, some but not all of the recommendations have been implemented, and several key issues remain. These include, one, ensuring access to and affordability of supervisory hours, two, requiring all third-party payers, commercial insurers, to reimburse in the same way that medical assistant does for supervisions and internships, and three, create training programs with stipends, scholarships, and pathways to licensure targeted at students from diverse communities, four, improve and expand cultural competency awareness training. The Wilder Foundation and the Mental Health Improvement Work Group, co-led by NAMI Minnesota and the Department of Human Services, also played a role in shaping this bill. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to have my testifiers proceed on the of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Vang, and thank you for bringing together the work group stakeholders and advocates in creating this legislation. So the first testifier I have is Sue Abderholden. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name, Ms. Abderholden, and affiliation for the record. And then proceed.
Madam Chair, members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and I'm just going to briefly walk you through the sections of the bill. So Section 1 really is just saying that all of the private payers have to pay for a clinical trainee. Right now, Medicaid does, and some private payers, but not all. And this creates, again, kind of shortages in our workforce if people can't find places to do their training. Section 2, 3, and 4 adds licensed alcohol and drug counselors to the list of professionals who are eligible to participate in the Health Professional Education Loan Forgiveness Program run by the Department of Health. Sections 5 through 11 basically say that the different boards for mental health professionals, so marriage and family therapy, behavioral health, psychologists, and social workers, we want to make sure that their boards represent the state. Social workers actually already have this into their part of the statute from last year, but we want to make sure we have people from rural Minnesota, and we want to make sure that we have people from diverse communities and underrepresented communities. The other thing that we add is making sure that we will, at some point, have a more culturally competent workforce as well. So we're requiring, at least 6 of their 40 hours of continuing education to be focused on culture, understanding culture, its functions and strengths, the differences among and between cultures, the nature of social diversity and oppression, and the understanding of cultural humility. Now, I know people have said, so what is cultural humility? The National Institute of Health defines it as a lifelong process of self-reflection and self-critique, whereby the individual not only learns about another's culture, but one starts with an examination of her or his own beliefs and cultural identities. Section 12 expands who can be a mental health practitioner. So we wanted to make sure that someone who is doing an internship in their fourth year of, say, social work, or their first year of a graduate program where they did not do an internship, can actually be a mental health practitioner so that the provider can actually bill for the care that they're providing. This will help so people aren't doing unpaid internships or even paying for their internship, which is really problematic, as you can imagine. Section 13 expands the use of our mental health grants to include paying for supervision for clinical trainees from BIPOC communities in clinics where they take Medicaid, but also wanting to make sure that we are paying for Native healers. Section 14 creates a culturally informed and responsive mental health task force so that we kind of continue to keep our focus on this important issue. Section 15 creates a work group to talk about alternative pathways to licensure, and you'll hear more from the testifiers, but what we know is we have a lot of people, way too many people, who actually graduate and then don't become licensed. And so we have this huge gap of people who oftentimes would be great clinicians, and they miss passing these national tests by a few points. And we know those national tests are, frankly, not culturally informed. So we want to make sure that we actually bring people together to figure that out. Section 16 requires the Department of Human Services and Health to convene the licensing boards to talk about how can we provide supervision across all licenses. Actually being able to use telehealth basically to do some supervision may help in the future, but you could be in a rural Minnesota clinic and you're trying to become a marriage and family therapist and there's no one who can provide that supervision who's also a marriage and family therapist. Could a clinical social worker, for example, then provide that supervision? So we want them to look at those issues. Section 17 appropriates funds for the culturally informed and culturally responsive task force. Section 18 helps us create more supervisors from the BIPOC community. So we would actually pay for their CEUs to become a supervisor. And then Section 19 appropriates funds for the LADCs as part of the loan forgiveness program, but also setting aside money to target mental health professionals from BIPOC communities. This is truly an amazing bill. It's been really wonderful to work on it. And I just want to remind people that if we don't have a culturally responsive workforce, what we end up is poor outcomes. So we know that Black men are diagnosed at a more frequent level with schizophrenia than their white counterparts with the very same symptoms. So we want to make sure that we get this right, and we want to make sure that everyone gets the appropriate and quality mental health care that they deserve. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden, for walking us through the bill, and thank you really for all of the work you're putting in to improve our treatment for mental health and other issues in healthcare. So you're a constant advocate, and we really appreciate your expertise. So our next testifier on the list is Pahu Yang from the Wilder Foundation. Please introduce yourself and welcome to the committee.
Hi, good morning. Pahua Yang from the Wilder Foundation. Thank you for having me here this morning. As both a social worker and a psychologist, I have lived through training and licensure for two of the fields represented in this bill. And the bill you have in front of you is a comprehensive bill aimed at investing in our workforce so that we can build a better mental health system that works for all Minnesotans. And the future of the mental health system really rests on the decisions that we make today. I want to address specifically the need to find alternative pathways for licensure for mental health professionals. For over 20 years across two states, I've watched colleagues both at Wilder and in the community repeatedly fail national board exams. And my initial bias was that they were just not studying hard enough. And then I began to understand that I was seeing a different iteration of the same issues that I've seen my entire life. And there's actually a whole branch of psychology devoted to studying how different populations score on tests, especially standardized tests. When I was working with first generation college students and students of color in higher education, I saw the exact same patterns there. Students coming out with 4.0s who were ranked top 10 out of 400, 500 students whose ACT scores were 16, 17, 18. I want to talk about some folks that I get the privilege of working with. I have staff at Wilder that have graduated from accredited programs, many of them nationally ranked. I have two women who have doctorates from APA accredited schools who can run circles around me as clinicians and who are pioneers in our field. One of them is leading a team doing work with some of our most vulnerable children and families in a way that nobody else in this country is doing. And we are getting incredible results. The other one has an area of expertise that makes her the only person like her in the nation. And yet, it took one of them over a decade and five times to pass the EPPP. The other person still hasn't passed after three tries, and she has chosen a different path at my encouragement so that I could finally pay her the salary for the work that she was already doing. And yet I count myself among the lucky few who can say to my staff, you will have a job whether you pass the test or not. Many of my colleagues in the community can't do that. I have seen highly skilled colleagues who have lost their jobs because of lack of licensure. Some have left the field completely. And I want us to think about the significance of this. In a time when we don't have enough workforce, we have highly competent people leaving the field simply because we have not been able to offer a different way to evaluate their competence. But here's the kicker for people who do stay in the field. Without a license, there is no career advancement. You make less than other people. You don't have the same title for doing the same work, and you can't practice independently. And too many times, highly skilled clinicians are getting supervised by people with less experience, but people who pass the test. I'm here today to ask you as leaders in our state for your help. We have a moment where we can keep doing the status quo, where we can keep choosing to do what we're doing, knowing that we are not building the workforce that we need for Minnesota, or we can choose to do something different. We can build a different system that works for Minnesotans by investing in our workforce. And this bill represents the opportunity to do that. So thank you for hearing me today.
Thank you, Dr. Yang. The next testifier is Dr. Gillett. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and then proceed with your testimony. I'm not seeing Dr. Gillett. Ms. Abderholden, is he with us today?
Madam Chair, yes, it's Dr. Willie Garrett.
Dr. Willie Garrett, maybe you're muted, but I'm not seeing you. There you are. Okay.
Can you hear me?
Well, okay. Yes, I can. Sorry about that. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name
welcome.
For the record.
Welcome to the committee. My name is Willie Garrett, and I want to thank the committee for allowing me to speak today. I am a psychologist. I've practiced in Minnesota for over 40 years now. I'm the president of the Minnesota Association of Black Psychologists, and I want to talk about the crisis in Black psychology and Black mental health at this point in time. I want to make a point that it's not just there's not just a shortage of Black psychologists, but there's a shortage of psychologists and therapists of all disciplines in the state of Minnesota. We have many counties. The last I read was that there were 9 counties in Minnesota that had no licensed mental health professionals, and there were many that have one. From the standpoint that I was the chair of the rural division of the Minnesota Psychological Association at one point. But right now, we have 25 licensed African-American psychologists. If you count every African-American therapist of every discipline, whether it's a social worker, professional counselor, marriage and family therapist, or psychiatrist, the ratio comes to 1 Black mental health professional for every 5,000 Black people in the state of Minnesota. Now, the recommended ratio is 1 for every 800. And so you can see that we have a huge shortage, and the shortage is at a crisis point, and it's getting worse because of multiple things. One of them is that most of us have gotten our degrees during the time of affirmative action, and now many of us are at a retirement age where people are leaving the state to return home or to care for aging parents. And so within the next 5 years or so, it looks like about half, at least, of the psychologists will be at a retirement point in their life. And so the shortage is getting worse, and the number of African-American students in graduate programs has decreased as well. And as Ms. Abderholden and Dr. Yang reported, when you have persons or therapists who are not trained in cultural competence, then the risks go up and the costs go up because they're misdiagnosed or they receive inappropriate treatment, and then they end up using expensive services such as inpatient hospitalization or ending up in prison as well. And right now, prison is like the number one provider of mental health care, at least for Black men at this point in time. The barriers for becoming licensed, a licensed professional, are many. One of them is just the cost of education has gone up dramatically. And then even if you get the education and you're working in the field, then there's the issue of getting a reasonable reimbursement for your work, having a decent salary, and you're having this reduction in income at a time when you have high student loans. But as was mentioned before, there's also the issue of the licensure exams. And I also know of many providers, not just African-American, but of other racial cultural groups who struggle to pass the licensure exams. And this is an incredible challenge because it costs so much money to get licensed. And then if you fail the exam, you got to take it again. It's sort of a year setback every time you don't pass the exam. So that's an issue as well. But this bill will increase the cultural competence of therapists going forward, and also offer the support services that they need, like supervision, for one, is desperately needed. But it's hard to get because supervisors aren't paid for it. Many times the students aren't paid for it. And so it's just hard to set up to get those hours that you need for licensure. But again, I want to thank all of you for allowing me to speak today. If you have any questions, I will be on to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Garrett. We appreciate your testimony. And this bill was discussed at length in Chair Fisher's committee. So we're going to look at, there's not a fiscal note completed yet, but the appropriation so far is $7 million over the biennium. I'm going to go to questions. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. The question is for, I suppose, Representative Vang, but for anyone familiar with the bill, is there some level of supervision for these trainees that are doing the counseling? And is the reimbursement rate at the same level? I realize that there is a crisis, that we need these people, but, you know, what other situation would we apply this to? There's a shortage in commercial pilots available. Would we use the same, would you have the same comfort level if your commercial pilot was a student?
Thank you, Representative Novotny. I think we'll have either Representative Vang or Ms. Abderholden, or we also have DHS or MDH is available to answer.
Chair, I can defer this to Ms. Abderholden.
Okay, Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair Member. There is supervision. So this does not eliminate supervision at all. It's when we have health plans, for example, paying for clinical trainees, which we do in pretty much every other area of healthcare, this retains the supervision that's required. It just makes it easier for an organization to provide supervision because they can actually bill for the care that's being delivered.
And Ms. Abderholden, can you address the question on reimbursement, or would you like me to direct that to MDH?
Madam Chair, since I don't do reimbursement at NAMI, I think MDH would probably be a better person to answer.
Thank you. So I think there's someone from MDH could help us answer Representative Novotny's second part of his question.
Thank you, Chair. This is Karen Fogg from MDH. Unfortunately, I don't cover this area, but we can take the question back to colleagues and get an answer.
Thank you, Ms. Fogg. Representative Novotny, do you have a follow-up?
That's fine. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Vang, for your work on mental health issues. I know this is, you know, my community isn't unique, but it's something I hear about all the time when talking with constituents, and the lack of you know, supply of healthcare professionals in the community and waiting lists to get to meet professionals. And so I appreciate your thoughtful work on this issue. The one question I had, Representative Bang, and I assume this is why it's going to be referred to the Commerce Committee, but this bill, to my understanding, has a new insurance mandate in it for private insurers. And I was wondering, Representative Bang, if you or any of the people you've been working with have any idea of what that's going to ultimately cost the private insurers or any impact that that could have on premiums here in Minnesota.
Representative Bang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Robinson, for your question. You know, I'm still waiting for the fiscal note to come back, and so hopefully that could help clarify what that will look like. And I could also defer this to my testifiers too, to see, you know, if they have a better clarification on that.
Thank you, Representative Bang. And that question probably falls more in line with Commerce, but we'll see if Ms. Abrilden wants to make a comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, you know, it isn't necessarily a new form of treatment. It's not new coverage. It's actually, they already pay for therapy. It's just making sure that a clinical trainee who's providing therapy can be covered. Some plans do, but not all of them do. Medicaid already does. So it's, again, it's not necessarily a new service. It's making sure that existing providers that can provide it are being reimbursed.
Representative Rasmussen, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, I'm sure we'll have a fuller discussion on this in Commerce, and so I'll leave it for that. But that's just one of the questions I'll have. And one of the concerns is, you know, as we pile on insurance mandates, you know, we can end up with higher premiums, and especially because we're only actually impacting a very small part of the total insured lives here in Minnesota. It can have some you know, adverse effects over time. But I do really appreciate, Representative Bang, your work on this issue. To try to increase the supply of mental health professionals here in Minnesota. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Vice Chair Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think this question may be for either Ms. Abderholden or for Dr. Yang. Or did I say that correctly? Yes. Yes, okay. The question is this. I mean, first I want to thank Representative Vang for bringing this forward for the bill. I'm particularly excited about the part talking about sort of that mentorship trainee relationship, as well as some of the telehealth. We've heard a lot of anecdotal evidence recently that the expansions of telehealth has made real improvements in folks having consistent mental health treatments, not missing appointments and all of that. So I'm hopeful that we can continue that. But the question that I have is around those tests. And I know this is a little bit slightly adjacent, but I'm curious. You know, we have a lot of folks you mentioned that may already be in the profession who are not able to pass the test, or really qualified, intelligent folks who are not able to pass the test and maybe abdicating a career in the field for that reason. And I'm just curious if there is underway or any body that is looking into the test itself, and where there might be points of failure that are maybe preventing folks who may be in the pipeline from being able to expand into the profession.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Dr. Yang?
Yes, absolutely. That's a great question. I will say that this is not an issue that's specific to Minnesota. This is a national issue. And we see these disparate pass rates all over the place. In fact, the state of Texas, because of these issues, have taken, you know, some has created some different licensure pathways. And so because, of course, they really need more bilingual, bicultural folks in their state as well in these positions. And so what I can tell you is that this is a national issue. There has not been, over the last 40 years, there has not been any research that has been able to correlate passage of licensure for any of these fields with competency. And so the research just simply is not there. And what we're asking for is to say there really isn't any research there that says these are, you know, these exams are equate competency. Therefore, you know, we can't change the nation, but we can figure some things out for Minnesota.
Vice Chair Bonner, do you have a follow-up?
I do. Thank you for that explanation. I appreciate that. And certainly I'd love to see more work done on that. And maybe we could take this offline, but I would be interested in having more understanding of how the model that, for example, you mentioned in Texas might be looking at additional pathways to make sure that there are other levels or pathways to get licensure. Certainly, maybe that's something that we should have a conversation about, and I'd be happy to take that offline as well. But thank you for that.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bonner. Representative Knorr.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Vang, for working with the stakeholders towards a culture-informed and culture-competent mental health and also other needs that I think this is a matter of life and death for so many members of the BIPOC community. In fact, it's a stigma when we talk about mental health or mental illness. So by providing someone who is more culturally competent, somebody who understands the deep knowledge of a specific ethnic group or cultural group, really helps us closing some of the significant disparities and challenges that many individuals face. So I just wanted to say thank you. I look forward to working with you on this bill and figuring out how we can provide that support. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Dr. Garrett. Dr. Garrett, you mentioned that the corrections facilities in Minnesota are the place where so many individuals, particularly Black men, need psychological counseling. Can you tell us what provisions are made in the corrections facility for both men and women and both people of color and people of the white backgrounds? What's available and mm-hmm. how are those people making the transition from incarceration to society again?
I
Dr. Garrett?
Hello. Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. Thank you for your question. I don't know the specifics about that. I just know that I don't know of any African-American therapists who are working within the prison system. None that I know of. And I have had clients who have been recently released from prison. And what they have reported to me is that a large percentage of the Black men in prison are on psychotropic medications. And so there is an awareness that mental illness is part of the reason why they are there. And so what we're seeing actually is persons who really are struggling with adapting, you know, to daily life, who end up in trouble. And so they go to prison, and finally a prison doctor, many times a medical doctor, will put them on a psychotropic medication. But that is not continued when they're released, because they get released into the community most of the time without having mental health services set up for them. And so that's part of the recidivism rate for Black, you know, prisoners.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the answer, and the situation is serious. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Representative Sandell and Dr. Garrett. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And thank you, Representative Bang, for bringing this bill. I have two quick questions, one for Dr. Yang and one for Ms. Abderholden. So for Dr. Yang, you know, I found it really interesting that you said that there is no correlation between passing the test and competency of the practice. And I just wondered, is that true in other professions? Because we have so many of these licenses and so many of these professional tests. And is that research that has been found in other areas? So if you could speak to that. And then Dr. Abderholden, You know, I'm wondering, you mentioned in earlier testimony that this training, paying for training is common in other areas of healthcare. And I just wondered if you could comment on, is that training the same? Because to me, it just seems like maybe a lesser amount, still reimbursed for the training, but clearly there's a difference between someone who's still learning and someone who's been a professional for a long time. So maybe a difference in reimbursement might be more sort of market-based and useful in how we handle this. So if you guys could both address those, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. I don't think we have any expertise on this committee about the reimbursement, but that can be addressed in the next committee stop. And I believe, Representative Robbins, if you serve on commerce, you'll get that information. Otherwise, we'll follow up with you with the agency. Dr. Yang or Ms. Abderholden?
I can address, you know, I haven't done a deep dive into other fields to look at whether the licensing process equals competency. What I know is for the mental health fields that we've listed after 40 years of licensure, there still isn't the research that says passing a test equals competency. And so we can certainly do more work in that area. But I'm not at this point able to speak to other fields.
Thank you, Dr. Yang. Ms. Abderholden?
And Chair, I just want to clarify that, you know, if you have a resident at a hospital and he or she is providing care, they're getting reimbursed for the treatment that they're providing. And so this is a similar thing, and they're all under supervision. What happens, though, in mental health care is that often a clinical trainee or someone who's doing their internship actually has to pay for the supervision, whereas often in other areas of healthcare, you know, we have different systems to actually, you know, provide those training programs. And so that's the problem. When they looked at the Department of Health data from 2007 to 2014, what we found is that only 49.1% of the people who graduated from programs became licensed. And the barriers are that they can't find a place to do supervision. And if the, you know, community mental health center can't bill that person for the services that they provide, they are much less likely to be able to provide the supervision for free as well. So those are some of the barriers we're trying to actually address.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Vang, for bringing this bill forward and for the testifiers today. Certainly, this is a really important issue and a great need in our state. Just a comment about the kind of the aspect of opportunities for students coming from background in healthcare and working in a teaching hospital. I, you know, can relate to the value of having, you know, care given by nursing students or medical residents that it definitely is a value to those students and with supervision from professionals, but a value to those patients as well. My question is, I'm wondering if it is known how many folks could potentially be in the pipeline who are working but not able to pass the certification, the licensure exams. Do we have a sense of how many people that is?
Dr. Yang or Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, I don't believe that we have that exact number. We were trying to see if there was a way to get it, but all we know is the number of people who graduate and the number of people who don't become licensed. I know that in meeting with Dr. Yang and others, we were trying to figure out if there was a way to get that from the national boards.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. And with that, members, we need to move on. So I'm going to renew my motion to re-refer House File 970 as amended to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. This will require a roll call vote. So, Ms. Hansen, Chair votes aye.
Schultz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Albright is excused. Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle? Representative Burkle? Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel?
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Mueller?
Aye.
Mueller, aye. Representative Noor?
Aye.
Noor, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, pass.
Novotny, pass. Thank you. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, pass.
Rasmussen, pass. Thank you. Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Robbins, aye. Representative Sandell?
Aye.
Sandell, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Aye. Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Burkle?
Burkle, aye.
Thank you, sir. So we have 15 ayes, 1 excused, and 2 abstain.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. The motion passes. Thank you, Representative Vang, for bringing your bill and to the testifiers. Yeah, so the next bill we have for consideration is House File 1026. I'll move that Representative Morrison's bill, House File 1026, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Omnibus Bill. I see that we have an A1 amendment. Representative Morrison, would you like me to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
Okay, I move the A1 amendment to House File 1026. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? A1 amendment is adopted. Welcome back, Representative Morrison, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to present House File 1026. As an OBGYN myself for almost 20 years, this bill creates, I think, a policy change that's very important in ensuring that pregnant women and their babies continue prenatal care and have good health outcomes. It exempts providers of prenatal care from being mandatory reporters of women who test positive for substances during their pregnancy. Minnesota has some of the most punitive laws and statute in this area. Currently, healthcare professionals or social service professionals are mandated to report a pregnant woman to a local welfare agency if she tests positive for any controlled substance other than alcohol or cannabis. Unfortunately, mandatory reporting of controlled substance use after prenatal screenings leads to distrust of providers and avoidance of prenatal care during pregnancy. Decades of research has shown legally mandated testing and reporting puts the therapeutic relationship between the physician and the patient at risk, potentially placing the physician in an adversarial relationship with the patient. Studies indicate that prenatal care greatly reduces the negative effects of substance use during pregnancy, including decreased risks of low birth weight and prematurity. Drug enforcement policies that deter women from seeking prenatal care are contrary to the welfare of the mother and baby. House File 1026 would amend those requirements to eliminate barriers to accessing prenatal care and improve access to addiction services. Pregnant women with substance use disorder should have access to comprehensive services, including prenatal care, drug treatment, and social support services, and not be worried that their newborn will be taken away from them. Addiction is a chronic, relapsing biological and behavioral disorder with genetic components. The disease of substance addiction is subject to medical and behavioral management in the same fashion as hypertension or diabetes. Madam Chair, I was hoping to have a very particular physician here to testify today, but unfortunately she is in clinic and providing care to the very women that I hope this change in law would help. So I'm going to read a quick testimony from Dr. Cresta Jones, who is an expert in this area. So she writes, my name is Dr. Cresta Wendell Jones, and I write to you today as the only physician in Minnesota who is board certified in both maternal fetal medicine, which is high-risk obstetrics, and addiction medicine. We know that women have better outcomes when they have regular prenatal care with a doctor or midwife. We know that babies do better when their mothers have regular prenatal care.
And this holds true for women who are struggling with substance use disorder, even those who are not ready or who are not able to access addiction medicine treatment will have better pregnancy outcomes and healthier babies if they are seen regularly for care throughout their pregnancies. I remain in support of the ability to place referral for child welfare services when women are a danger to themselves or their developing baby. But this may be done, must be done in a discretionary fashion that allows us to develop a relationship with the patient and continue to engage her in prenatal care. I leave you with a case that I will carry with me throughout my career. A patient came to see me who admitted to me that she was struggling with dependence to opioid pain pills, but was not yet in a place where she could get into treatment. She was scared and she didn't yet trust me. She was informed that based on her disclosure at that first visit that I was required to make a report to the local child welfare services. She became angry, told me she could not trust me to care for her and her baby, and she left. She never returned, and several months later, I found that she had overdosed on fentanyl and died, along with her developing baby, as she was still pregnant. If I had had the time to gain her trust and support her, would this have happened? Could I have saved them? I believe that with a change in mandatory reporting, I will at least have that opportunity. So I'm disappointed that you all don't get to meet Dr. Jones in person. She's pretty remarkable. So I thank her for sharing that with us. So seeking prenatal care should not expose a woman to criminal or civil penalties, such as incarceration, involuntary commitment, loss of custody of her children, or loss of housing. These approaches treat addiction as a moral failing, and we know better now. So I ask for your support for House File 1026, and I do have three testifiers to follow.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Dr. Slagle, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Elizabeth Slagle, and I am a practicing OBGYN in St. Paul. I'm the Vice Chair-elect of the Minnesota section of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. I represent nearly 1,000 providers of women's health care in the state of Minnesota and strongly support House File 1026, and we're so happy to have Dr. Morrison as a champion for us. We can all agree that addiction and substance use disorders represent a public health emergency. And the question at the core of the discussion today is, does our law of mandatory reporting of substance use in pregnancy actually help our mothers and babies? And I'm here to tell you that despite the best of intentions, the current law makes the problem worse. Pregnancy is a time when many women are very motivated to seek care, to improve their health and address addiction. Criminalizing substance use disorders has been proven to be counterproductive. And our approach to substance use in pregnancy should be to support our women and give them either further motivation to support their health and improve the health of themselves and their families. Mandatory reporting promotes a steady undercurrent of fear in our communities, and this fear erodes the trust between a woman and her provider and becomes a major deterrent to prenatal care. I have had countless patients that have been lost to prenatal care when concerns around substance use are surfaced. One patient who had been engaged in prenatal care, had been engaged in treatment for opioid use addiction, unexpectedly became pregnant and then lost to care. She ended up experiencing heavy bleeding at around 30 weeks of pregnancy and emergently delivered a premature low birth weight infant who spent many months in the neonatal intensive care unit. The patient stated later that she stopped accessing care once she became pregnant, fearing that she would be penalized for her addiction and have her child taken from her. In obstetrics in the United States, we are fighting a huge rise in maternal mortality, enormous health inequities, and rising rates of substance use. In the U.S., it is more dangerous to have a baby now than it was a generation ago, and it's far more dangerous for women of color. We need to make every effort that each law and policy as it relates to pregnancy care has the effect of improving access to care, improving trust with providers, and reducing maternal morbidity and mortality. I have taken an oath to treat my patients with dignity and respect and to always strive to establish a therapeutic alliance with my patients. I also believe in the ethical responsibility to discourage the separation of parents from their children solely based on substance use disorders. And I implore you all today to align the law to this oath and responsibility by supporting House File 1026. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Slagle. Slagle. Thanks for being with us today. The next on the list is Dr. Alibi. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Elizabeth Alibi, and I have worked at Hennepin Healthcare in obstetrics and gynecology for the last 4.5 years. I'm currently located at the Brooklyn Park downtown campus, as well as Hennepin County Jail. Today, I'm responsible for delivering babies, and so I'll try to keep my testimony short as I might be called away unexpectedly. At Hennepin Healthcare, roughly 80% of the people who birth within our system are on Medicaid, and the majority of our pregnant, birthing, and postpartum patients are Black, Indigenous, and people of color. Maternal health providers see firsthand the stressors that moms experience while pregnant in that first year after birth. Pregnancy is a time where many women enter into the medical system, and it's also a time that they are motivated towards substantial change. I meet with mothers all the time who are doing the right thing by getting the care that they need, including treatment for substance abuse disorder, as well as mental health services while pregnant. We already work with a demographic of patients who have a significant distrust of the medical system. And then we spend an entire pregnancy building that trust, helping moms get the full breadth and benefit of prenatal care, only to have that trust undermined by reporting moms who have been obtaining with compliance substance abuse treatment. The fear of having their child taken away is now a barrier and deterrent to care. We know that prenatal care, education, and supportive programs are some of the biggest determinants of improving outcomes in both mother and child. I recently was in a birth with a mom who had a history of substance abuse. We called in the neonatal intensive care team, the NICU, as she was nearing delivery, not because of her history, but because the baby had a bowel movement during labor, as is our protocol. And as soon as the NICU entered into the delivery room, she began crying out in the middle of pushing, "Please don't take my baby. Please don't take my baby." And the fear that she felt regarding CPS essentially swooping in to take her baby, who was not even born yet, was palpable throughout the room. She completely shut down after this, as did her interaction with the medical care team. We know that CPS involvement is disproportionate regarding our Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And we also know that dividing families don't necessarily improve outcomes. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to share this story with you. I think this bill will truly mean allowing moms, babies, and families the opportunity to stay together, allowing us to put more focus on prevention, education, and support. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Alibi, and thank you for being with us today. The next testifier is Professor Silverstand. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Anna Silverstand, and I'm an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Minnesota, working with the medical discovery team on addiction. I represent a team of researchers at the U of M that has an opportunity to participate in a landmark brain and child development study funded by the National Institute of Health. This study plans to involve 10,000 pregnant women across 25 study sites in the United States starting this fall to study the effects of neonatal abstinence syndrome, a medical condition in which babies experience drug withdrawal symptoms after birth. Unfortunately, in the past 15 years, the incidence of neonatal abstinence syndrome has increased fivefold nationally and ninefold in Minnesota. While preparing this study, I've talked to several lawyers about mandated prenatal reporting in Minnesota, and after months of preparations, it is still unclear if and how we will be able to conduct the study without legal risk for the participating women. Minnesota is the only state among the 25 sites that are participating which has mandated reporting of substance use during pregnancy by researchers or educators, making it nearly impossible for us to conduct our study without adding legal risks for these women, even though we are providing healthcare services to women who are participating. This bill would change this, and I'm absolutely convinced that passing it would improve the future welfare of the mothers and these unborn babies, both in the short term but also in the long term, through the scientific insights that we will gain. This is also important because without us participating, there won't be any data specifically on Minnesotans. And I want to stress this, we will invite families from all across the state to participate. Finally, we've been flagged on the national level by the National Institute of Health as being the state with the most punitive legal situation among the current grant applicants. This now not only risks our application to be a study site, but also risks the chance of the U of M to be the data center for the entire study unless this law is changed. I thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'm available for questions. Thank you, Representative Morrison, for authoring this important legislation.
Thank you, Professor Silverstand. The last testifier I have is Michelle Teberg. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for having me today. My name is Michelle Teberg, and I am a registered nurse. My husband and I are licensed foster parents through the state of Minnesota, and we have had not one but two newborn babies come to us immediately after being discharged from the hospital following their birth. Both of these precious babies are victims of drug abuse by their mothers while pregnant. We have personally witnessed the negative effects this has had on both babies. Although I am unsure if this bill will be helpful if passed, I am here to strongly encourage every voting body to consider the crucial need to get these drug-using mothers into committed treatment as soon as possible by medical providers, social workers, and any other professional that may need to be involved. These innocent children have no voice or choice in the matter and sadly will potentially live the rest of their lives with issues. If this bill is passed today, I feel strongly that it needs to be followed up on regularly to determine if it has been more helpful or not, and if not, for something else to be considered. If this was happening to unborn children in your own families, how would you vote to make your little loved ones a priority? The safety, health, and general well-being of children should come first. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing me to testify at today's hearing. I appreciate your time and consideration very much. And if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Ms. Teberg. Any other comments, Representative Morrison, before we go to questions?
I don't think so. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Schultz, and I speak in favor of this bill. There are some minor things that might have objections to, but the important thing is to keep first things first. And the fact that the mother is wanting to go to the doctor's office to start with indicates that she does want to do the best that she can for the unborn child, and that is her opportunity to get the help and maybe get into the treatment. That is her best avenue for getting the help that she needs. In my past job, having dealt with several of these situations where the mothers during heavy drug use have gone underground and have hid and have had the babies born, for lack of a better term, off-grid, because not only are they hiding from the authorities, they're hiding from their own families. I think it's much better that they have that trust with a doctor who might be able to help them or might be able to treat the baby immediately after it's born. You know, having seen the effects of a baby that's born to a mother that's using, that's a very high risk situation. So if we keep the first things first, I think this is important. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Novotny. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have had some personal experience watching babies in neonatal. I had a grandson, twins that were born early. One of them had IUGR, which I'm guessing Dr. Morrison knows all about. Actually, and another grandson that had been born earlier at 4 pounds, and it turned out he had IUGR. And so they all ended up in neonatal, and grandma got to be there to watch and see more than just my own grandchildren. Actually, some addicts that were there. My concern is, as we look toward helping mothers, there was neglect before and after the baby was born. You could see it. It really was sad to see. And obviously the moms were having major problems besides having a baby that was not going to be on their, they just couldn't be responsible for the baby. So my concern is, I think it's wonderful that we're talking about preborn babies. I think that is absolutely from conception to long after they're born, there is some major things that need to happen with babies. And they're highly demanding. We all know that as mothers, we know how challenging that can be. And if a child is born with drug problems, it is that much more. So I know we need to get going. I can see Chair looking at me like, move on, Deb. Anyway, I have a real passion for this. I really wonder, are we able to help turn this around? How does it look? What do other states do? I don't want people to think that they can be on drugs and keep doing this, because we see the damage. Michelle Tiberg said, you know, we see the damage long after they're born, and I've seen lifetime of damage because I happen to know somebody that was on drugs long before they had kids. So how are we going to keep mothers involved in childcare, both from conception all the way to past that, if they come to the hospital or the clinic and identify that they're pregnant, and I'm guessing they don't know until, you know, a few months later that they realize, well, there's something else going on here. Or it could be possible, let's put it that way. And I'm just wondering, Representative Morrison, have we checked at other states to see how they're dealing with this, and what might our results be? What are we looking for?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Keel. I share your passion for these issues. My career has been devoted to them. But you bring up a lot of big societal questions, and we are in the midst of an opioid epidemic and a substance use epidemic that has been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. So there are all kinds of big overlapping and intersecting issues that touch on this. But when someone is suffering from a substance use disorder or an opioid use disorder, it is a really difficult medical condition, and they need all the support that they can get. And the mere baseline is being able to trust their healthcare provider to initiate that. We know we have rising rates of neonatal abstinence syndrome, and we know that a healthy percentage of babies born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, which means that their mother had been using substances during the pregnancy, that a healthy percentage, I believe it's 20% of those women, had no prenatal care whatsoever. So the sooner that we can get these pregnant people into their healthcare provider to develop that trusted relationship, the better chance we have and they have of getting the treatment that they need, getting off of the substances, and giving their babies the best possible shot at the best possible life. And I think that in terms of what's going on in other states, there's a lot of evidence that supports this approach. And we do have evidence in states that have, and I should defer to Professor Silverstein on this, but we do have evidence from states that have very punitive laws around pregnant women, that they have much higher rates of neonatal abstinence syndrome, of lack of prenatal care, and of all of the societal fallout that comes after that. So I don't know if Professor Silverstein wants to comment as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Dr. Slagle, or I'm sorry, Professor Silverstein, do you want to comment?
Thank you for the question. Thank you. I would like to comment that I'm a psychologist by training, and there is an abundance of evidence that creating fear is the worst motivator for behavioral change, and that I have talked to a dozen of clinics in the past months, that and every single one of them has told me they're losing patients because of the fear that prenatal reporting creates. So there is no doubt that this creates fear, and I think ultimately we all have the same goal. We all want to treat these women and help the families to recover, and ensuring the trust between the provider and the person that seeks care will be the best way to do this, and there is an abundance of scientific support for this. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Silverstand. Let's see, going to the other members' questions, I have, Representative Keel, did you have a follow-up? You're muted, Representative Keel.
Sorry about that. My statement would just be, where are we going from here? If we're not reporting, what happens then? And are we creating a bigger problem than we already did? I get the fear. I really do. I saw it myself. And delivering is a highly intensive experience. So depending on where you are in your past, I just wonder if we're open-ended, leaving more problems to need to be solved. And yeah, so thanks.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And having been a licensed foster care provider myself and gone through the training that deals with a lot of these prenatal issues and substance abuse during pregnancies and how that impacts them, I'm actually a little bit surprised that alcohol was excluded from this. And I feel like that specifically can inform us on how doctors are actually using this in practice today. We're basically eliminating the mandatory reporting. We went back and with the amendment, I understand we made it so that if someone stops getting care, then that becomes a mandatory reporting incident once again, once that person has terminated their prenatal care. My question is, a little bit nuanced in the fact that the doctors still have the freedom or the ability, again, if they're looking out for the best interest of the child, if things still aren't going well, do they have the capability of doing reporting, even though it's not mandatory? And I guess I kind of asked the question almost in that same context of how alcohol is currently treated, because it's not a mandatorily reported incident. I'm just wondering how doctors are applying this in practice, and if that can inform us on how this would impact what would happen with other chemical dependencies.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pearson. I appreciate your bringing up alcohol because it is a little odd. We have the most evidence about the detrimental effects of alcohol in pregnancy, and yet we treat it very differently than we treat opioids, for example. And I want to briefly go back to Representative Keel's comment. And I agree, this issue can feel very overwhelming, but I really think we're currently making it worse by creating this barrier between patients and providers. This is the earliest, best first step to get people into the care that they need. And I absolutely understand the concern, but this is about bringing down barriers to accessing care and to helping pregnant people get the care they need and become healthy. And, if you make the analogy to diabetes, for example, if you have a pregnant person who is really struggling to manage her blood sugars, we would never think about reporting her to the authorities and consider removing her child from her. She has a difficult medical condition to manage, and it is analogous. We kind of need a mindset change. And blood sugars, high blood sugars in mom are detrimental to the developing fetus. So I just wanted to touch on that. And then Representative Pearson, I'm already forgetting what your questions were, but you talked about alcohol. And then in terms of current practice, the bill does still allow for reporting if there is concern about the patient being a harm to herself. and if there is recurrent habitual use. And there's also the amendment that Senator Benson in the Senate worked out, and that Dr. Jones, who's very much on the front lines of this issue, agreed with. It allows some discretion for the provider to, if the patient, after, you know, contracting to let's be in this together and work together, recurrently does not show for care, then there is a provision where the provider can report. So I think it strikes a good balance between making sure that patients are coming in to get care, trusting their providers, and then also being careful to look out for their well-being.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Representative Pearson, do you have a follow-up?
I do, Madam Chair. Again, Representative Morrison, you're doing a great job defining exactly the terms of the question. And again, maybe it's a better question for the practitioners to address, just based on, again, we have an example in the fact that we know alcohol has this absolute negative consequence of exposure of a fetus to alcohol in utero, and that baby that's in there, you know, that we have to look out for the best interest of that baby. And I fundamentally support the bill. I get the concept. I get what you're going for. But I guess I'm really trying to get to the heart of my question is, how do we in practice apply this with alcohol right now? Because it isn't mandatorily required that it be reported if the doctor determines or is aware that, you know, the blood tests show that the mother carrying a baby has alcohol in their system. They are not mandatorily required to report that, but how are they, how often or when do they then make that step to make the decision to report, even though it's not required?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Pearson. Providers of prenatal care screen all pregnant women for all substance use during pregnancy. And if alcohol use is reported, and it states it explicitly in the bill as well, that any person can make a voluntary report if the person knows or has reason to believe that a woman is pregnant and has used a controlled substance for a non-medical purpose during the pregnancy, et cetera, in a way that is habitual or excessive. And then, so that there is discretion in existing law and in this bill as well. So that's an ongoing conversation that providers have with patients. And the sooner a patient gets in for prenatal care, the sooner those conversations can be initiated and the better the chance that the patient will disclose to the provider so that they can work together towards solutions.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just thank you so much, Representative Morrison, and to the presenters. So powerful, and I really appreciate it. And I guess I was going to ask a couple of questions, but I think I'll connect Representative Morrison offline about them. But I just want to highlight the addition of the phrase care for the woman's infant, that this is not just during prenatal and postpartum care, but also focusing on the care for the child. That what we're talking about is substance use during pregnancy. So retrospectively and going back, and I just really appreciate, we've talked a lot about the impact on the mom, which is so important, but on the child as well. But that's a time when we really want newborns to be receiving medical care and to be have their families be in contact with physicians. Anyway, so I really appreciate that. And as I said, I'll ask some questions from Representative Morrison separately, but this is just a terrific bill, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. And I see that, Representative Novotny, your hand is raised, but I'm assuming that maybe you didn't lower it, but just to double check.
My mistake, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Okay, I'm not seeing any more questions. Thank you, Representative Morrison. Any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the conversation, and I'm very grateful to our testifiers today for providing their expert testimony and for the work that they do for our pregnant Minnesotans, new moms and babies as well. I really, this is a difficult subject, but it's one that needs to be tackled, and I'm grateful for your interest and support.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. I'm gonna renew my motion to lay House File 1026 as amended over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. And thank you for our testifiers today as well. So the next bill we have for consideration is House File 1202. So I'll move that Representative Wolgamott's bill, House File 1202, be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. So Representative Wolgamott, we have the bill before us. Welcome to the committee. I don't see any amendments, and it looks like you have one testifier. So please introduce yourself and proceed at explaining your bill today.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you very much, committee members. As Chair Schultz said, I'm Dan Wolgamott from District 14B. This is my first time presenting in front of this committee, and it's an honor to be here. I'm here today because, like all of you, the safety and well-being of Minnesota's children is a top priority. It's personal for me as a dad of $2 to make sure that all Minnesota children who are in dangerous situations get the care and the protection that they need. That's why I'm bringing forward House File 1202, which is going to give our child protection services the tools and increased efficiency to be able to get and direct visits to children endangered in a more efficient and focused manner. Madam Chair and members, this bill would amend the current statute to reflect two exceptions to the child protection immediate response timelines without compromising child safety. These two exemptions are when the victim is in a location that is confirmed to restrict contact with the alleged offender, and when a court order to see the child is being sought. I want to note that a very similar bill was brought forward last year by my late friend and colleague, Senator Jerry Relf, as well as Representative Dave Pinto. That bill was going through, but of course, as we know, COVID kind of upended everything last year. So we're back here again. And Madam Chair, before I kick it over to my testifiers, I just want to note that I've heard no opposition to this bill, not aware of any opposition, but we're still looking forward to sharing our perspective with the testifier, and then we'll be more than happy to take your questions. So again, thank you, Madam Chair and members. And with that, I'll kick it over to my testifier.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. I have Jody Hurong-Dick. Introduce yourself to the committee, state your affiliation, and proceed, and welcome.
Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jody Hurong-Dick, and I'm a Child and Family Service Manager with Sherburne County. Today, I'm testifying on behalf of Sherburne County and the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. I'd also like to point out that we've collaborated with the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Inter-County Association on this legislation, as well as the Department of Human Services. Both last year and this year, the department has been able to provide technical assistance to us on the language for this bill. So I want to explain that when a report of child maltreatment is screened in, meaning that it meets the criteria for an investigation or an assessment, that the agency really has two response timelines available. One is the 24-hour response timeline, and one is a 5-day response timeline. This legislation specifically does look at the 24-hour response timeline, and those are cases that involve egregious harm, which are sexual abuse cases, or substantial child endangerment cases. We do believe child safety is paramount to us, and that these timelines extensions that we're asking for really only apply when we know that the child is safe. So we are looking for two exceptions, and I can provide some examples of each exception. When the child is residing in a location that is confirmed to restrict contact with the alleged offender. An example of this is if we have a child who's in a residential treatment facility getting treatment, and they disclose sexual abuse, that they were sexually abused by an older sibling, we would need to respond within 24 hours and see that child do a face-to-face contact. We believe in these situations that there are staff available providing 24/7 supervision, and that the facility dictates who can come and go from that facility. So in a situation like that, we really feel that the child is confirmed to be safe in that situation. The second example here might be if a child is in a hospital setting. So if we have a child who has entered a hospital due to mental health issues, and during their course of treatment disclose that they were sexually abused, this would be another case where an exception, we're asking that an exception be available so that we know that that child is safe, that they're in a setting getting supervised 24/7, and that that contact would be monitored. So we really believe children would be safe in that setting as well. The second exception really talks about when the agency has done diligent efforts to see that child, but has been not unsuccessful in seeing that child. So we would first in these cases prefer to go to the home unannounced to see the child. Sometimes we get to the home and there is nobody there, but we have a tight timeline to have to be able to make contact with that child. So in those situations, we may call a parent and talk with them and let them know what the report is, that we need to respond, that we need to see their child, and ask to make those arrangements to see that child. This doesn't happen often, but it does happen on occasion where the parent refuses to cooperate and their whereabouts may be unknown. They're unwilling to share with us where the child is, where they're at, and so we're unable to comply with that 24-hour response timeline. In those cases, we would work with our county attorney's office. We would talk with them about getting an order from the judge to basically order the parents to present the child for an interview. We don't have to have hearings on those matters to get a court order. It typically is the county attorney's office asking the court, and then the court deciding if there's enough information available to create a court order in that situation. So again, under these exceptions that we're asking for, the postponement of face-to-face contact would not exceed 5 days. So we're not asking that it be eliminated altogether, but we're asking for like a 5-day delay to making that contact. And that really does allow counties to prioritize investigative resources across their agency to meet the needs of the most imminent risk cases that are coming in. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony today. I'll open it up now for questions from members. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. I did carry a version of this last year, so I appreciate you carrying it. I just want to note for members that I did speak with the Executive Director of Safe Passage for Children, which is a child welfare advocacy group, and he confirmed that that organization isn't supportive of, or I should maybe just say does not have concerns with the proposal. So I did want to make sure to check with them. I think that was important to a number of members on this committee that happened, so just wanted to kind of check the box on that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto, for letting us know. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not too sure who's best to answer the question I have. I was taking a look at line 1.18, where the child is residing in a location confirmed to restrict contact with the alleged offender. I'm just wondering how the restrict contact with the offender, is that just in person, or does that also include if the offender is trying to contact the child by social media?
Representative Wolgamott, or to your testifier?
Chair, I would reference my testifier to this.
Okay, Ms. Harang-Dick, can you respond to Representative Fisher's question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So yes, the agency would have the ability to talk with the entity, whether it's the hospital or the residential treatment setting, to give them the information that a report has come in, and that in order to ensure that child's safety, we would want to put specific parameters in place until we could get out there and further assess the situation.
Representative Fisher?
Thank you. That's just so I was wondering. Sometimes I see it and I think more face-to-face, and I sometimes forget about, does that also include the social media aspect where some of these predators live on? So thank you for clarifying that. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. I'm not seeing any more questions from members. Representative Wolgamott, any closing comments?
Yes. Again, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you very much to the members of this committee. Thank you very much to the people in our counties all throughout the state who are involved in child protection services. It's I can't imagine doing that work, but it's so important. Every child in Minnesota deserves to be safe, deserves to be protected. And Madam Chair and members, I appreciate your consideration of House File 1202 so that we can give those child protection services folks all throughout the state more flexibility to do their job more efficiently and make sure all of our children are safe and protected. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. With that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1202 be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. And with that, members, we are going to be meeting tomorrow to hear about Representative Knorr's bill on Families First and Representative McDonald's bill. And then Friday, we are going to start meeting on Fridays at 10:30 because we're getting more bills referred to our committee. So please put on your calendar meeting at 10:30 on Friday, and we're waiting for a bill to get through the reviser. So keep abreast of the committee, and you'll get an email confirming our Friday hearing. And then we're going to, I think, book those until the end of deadline through March for Fridays. And you will get more information via email if you haven't already. So with that, members, we are adjourned.